Hey guys, welcome to this week's Money and Investing Show. This week we are looking at China and specifically some of the events within the construction sector and where they may lead us. Debt, deflation, demographics, three big challenges for the Chinese economy and indeed for the rest of the world that are trading partners. Make sure you take plenty of notes and as always, make sure you take plenty of action. Hey guys, welcome to this week's Money and Investing Show with me, your host, Andrew Baxter, and as always, my offsider and co-host, Mitchell Laurential.
Really excited about today's episode, AB, because I know it's going to help a lot of investors and our traders out there. I want to talk about the impacts and the challenges with China at the moment. Plenty of economic data to go through, and I no doubt we'll get a history lesson from you today. Ultimately, I know we'll lead down the pathway of what the trading opportunities are and what the hazards are. So big episode inbound, and where do we get started?
Oh, look, it's a huge country, it's a huge story, and it's going to have huge ramifications, I think, from a trading and investing perspective. And, you know, as always, as you know, the past leaves clues, as does success. And I think you've got to look back into Chinese history to understand specifically where some of the roadblocks and challenges that the current economy is facing. And I think as we go through the podcast today in our conversation, I think we'll arrive at, you know, where some of the investment opportunities really are. But I think probably more importantly, is where some of the risks really sit for people too, because there's no question about it. This is a has the capacity to be a really substantial event-driven period of trading, and it could be quick, or it could be, in the case of Japan, the lost decade. But we will see.
That's right. And world's second largest economy for perspective out there for our listeners, and a huge trading partner for us here in Australia as well, particularly in the mining space.
Massively. Yeah.
Let's wind back the clock. Let's go back to 1978.
Yes.
And I believe China, when they opened up their reform, they modeled themselves on Japan and South Korea.
That's right. Deng Xiaoping, the whole thing, reform and opening, and China realized that it needed to be part of the world stage. Up until that point in time, it was fairly insular and insulated, and they decided to open up. And the model they used, which at the time, 1978, you wouldn't pick a better model than probably Japan or South Korea. Obviously, time has subsequently shown us that the Japanese model came spectacularly crashing to earth. 1989, actually, the all-time high in the Nikkei, 38,915 points. Bit of trivia for you there.
There you go.
And it's never come close to that since. And the Japanese economy was saddled with three main issues: bad debt, deflation, and demographic challenges, particularly in the form of an aging population. And an older population typically consumes less. And we're starting to see all three of those Ds, the debt, the deflation, and the demographics really start to hit in China. So yeah, Deng Xiaoping opened the country up, saw a huge amount of foreign direct investment coming in, a lot particularly through Hong Kong. And you've got regions like Guangdong, where it was a sleepy old coastal part of the world, and now it is the world's supply chain hub, which, you know, is really quite extraordinary over a relatively short period of time. And I guess, like any economy, as you start to migrate your population from, be very minded of the term, being peasants or working literally subsistence farming on the land, to involving them in an industrialization, to all intents and purposes, it was China's industrial revolution. Happened in the UK several hundred years ago, but the same thing, where people moved off the land into factories and manufacturing and so on. And what you started to see was a significant wealth creation on the back of that. There's also changed a lot as the country has become more wealthy. And if we look at just in the last, say, 15, 18 years, back in 2006, 67% of Japan, China's export or manufacturing went straight out to exports. If you look at foreign trade as a proportion of GDP, now it's about 35%.
So it's a powerhouse, not so long.
So now you've got this self sort of combustible furnace of consumption going on as people have become more and more wealthy. And that then has led on to the next boom, which is, or was, or may perhaps have been in the past, depending on how it all turns out, in the construction sector. So you start to see this enormous development of the country and massive, massive inroads into, particularly into construction, which, we've talked about this in this podcast previously. Construction is such a massive amplifier of economic activity. It's called the multiplier effect. And that's why you know, during the pandemic, we saw the government really stimulating the construction sector. It turned out to be overly stimulated because for every dollar you spend there has maybe a 10 or 12 times impact because that money gets spent on supplies and raw materials, and somebody buys a ute and some flavored milk and a at the newsagent, and someone gets employed there and the whole thing spills over. So construction is a terrific way of really charging within your economy.
Well, I think back in, as you say, around 2006, construction was, I think, nearly 14% of China's GDP. So that was when they probably really started to boom, right? Things were going great. And from my understanding, the Chinese property market, a lot of vacancy, but because prices were going up at the speed of light, everyone was happy just to sit on these properties, which were tripling, quadrupling in value, right?
Exactly right. And, you know, 70% of the Chinese population's store of wealth is now in real estate. So this notion that if you build these cities, and we've all seen the different portrayals, whether it be on YouTube or on the TV, of these ghost cities where there's enormous cities that are built, it's all empty, no one lives there, and yet they've appreciated in value, just swept up with the general movement in property prices, has been nothing short of, well, it's peculiar, I think would be the term. But yeah, literally buying something and having it as a lockup and just sitting back and talk about passive investment. I mean, it's almost the ultimate in passive investing when something like that happens. But it's a peculiar thing, and like anything that's peculiar, when the music stops, you don't want to be holding the package. And I guess we're in a situation now whereby you know, things have really started to shift quite considerably, particularly within construction within China, but also across the broader economy there.
Speaking of being stuck holding the baby, to throw another number at you, AB, I think, you know, 20% of the tax revenue in China is collected via real estate. So this is a big component if there is a slowdown.
Enormously so, and even more so at a local government level. So that's talking about state government. At a local government level, it's nearly a quarter of their revenue comes from property.
Wow.
So there's been this huge encouragement for developers to buy land and develop, because there's obviously been quite an incentive for local government. So, you know, that's been the story until now. What's really starting, or where have things gone wrong? And a lot of people would have seen Evergrande, which, you know, 6-8 months ago, I think we talked about in a podcast previously, which was filing for bankruptcy protection. It's just done that in the US, Chapter 15, bankruptcy protection in the US to try and protect its US-based assets. Yeah, this is a company that's saddled with the world's biggest amount of debt. It's something like $480 billion worth of debt. And a lot of that debt is held in properties that maybe you can't sell or that are going to remain vacant. And when the backside started to move out of a property market and prices are moving down, it becomes a real challenge. So why did the music change there? And the answer is really simple. Development is a high risk space. We've got a number of clients and developers. I've done my fair share of developing over time as well. And there are some potentially massive returns to make, and there's potentially some pretty big risk that goes with it too. And I guess, you know, we've seen a swag of construction companies go belly up here in Australia because of the cost of construction going higher, but also the cash management practices within those businesses too. So traditionally, if you're building a high rise, for example, you've got to sell about a third, maybe it's a quarter to a third of the units in there before you've broken dirt to get the funding to then get out of the ground. And in the case of China, if you look at the proportion of funding that's come either from people who've bought a property, it's not completed yet. And this is the challenge. So you've bought a property, I'm the developer, you've given me the cash. I haven't finished the job yet, but I'm taking the money that you've given me, including what would be my profit margin in that, and I've funneled it straight into my next project. So I haven't finished the other job yet, and I need the money to do that, but it's going to appreciate in value anyway, so no one's got any stress. But when things stop going up,
house of cards,
it becomes a very, very different proposition. So if you look at the traditional, as accurate as these statistics can be, bearing in mind they're coming out of China and so on, is that if you look at the proportion from, say, 2015 through to now, back in 2015, about 62% of the cash flow that developers used either came from sales of an uncompleted apartment and or a mortgage or borrowing that the developer has then sourced. Look at that figure now, it's about 80.5% of their working capital comes from money that you've paid for an unfinished project, or indeed from borrowings. And most of the borrowing that was done, just like in the US, is done against treasuries, where yields were incredibly low. So interest rates in the US were very, very low. They're maybe half 1% on a bond. So your cost of finance was incredibly low if you were laying your risk off against the US Treasury. But we've seen the Fed in the US now increase rates at the sharpest rate in history. And we've seen interest rates move up, you know, substantially from being effectively zero to over 5.5%. So all of a sudden, your funding cost for 80% of what you're doing over here has gone from being almost free money to being more expensive money.
That's really tough.
And that's where a lot of the rivets have started to pop off the engine and the whole thing has started to break down. And that subsequently is going to have a major knock-on effect, not just for China, but the rest of the world too.
So looking at the Chinese economy right now, AB, fast forward to present day, we've got lower imports, lower exports, higher unemployment, particularly in the youth. Demographic, deflation, interest rates going down lower, which is totally opposite to the rest of the world, and an economy which is really in a bad situation.
Yep.
What happens from here?
Yes, that's
what happens from here. Because that's a huge risk, particularly for us in Australia. Yeah. We've got a huge reliance with China.
Look, the anecdotal evidence and like some of the statistics, I say, when they come out of other countries can be somewhat questionable. And that's not to say, you know, even in say, the US or the other Western economies, the statistics have a habit of being revised and seasonally adjusted over time. So, you know, that's taken with a grain of salt. But specifically, if you look at imports and exports, they're down 4.5% and 6.5% respectively, which is a significant slowing for the world's second largest economy. It shows there's a dramatic slowdown going on. The Chinese government now stopped reporting on youth unemployment. The last number that came out was around 23%. So they cannot create enough jobs for the graduates coming out of university. So there are some demographic challenges that are coming on through there as well. And as you say, interest rates have been coming down. Now, if you compare China to Japan and the issues that Japan had, particularly through the 1990s as its economy went through, you know, the lost decade as it was known, Japan had reasonably high interest rates and reasonably high wages. Whereas in China, you've got fairly low wages still, even though wages have increased over time, they're still relatively low by global standards. And you've also got declining interest rates. So that's one thing that the Chinese government have got in play. They haven't gotten overly inflated because it's been manipulated or pegged, if you will. They haven't got an overly inflated currency, so they can devalue their currency. They can do a lot of stuff there to try and ease the pain that they've got. But the problem of having enormous levels of debt, which all of these construction companies do, and Evergrande is just one of several, it just happens to be the largest one to date. That debt is a real problem, particularly when it's financed at relatively low interest rates and global interest rates have moved higher. The other thing you can't move away from are the demographic challenges, where you've got an aging population, you've also got a shrinking population, you've got no migration policy, and for the prospects for people coming out of uni and so on, the career path isn't there now either, which has the potential to cause a level of civil unrest. And then if you look at deflation, where if people are concerned about their, bearing in mind 70% of people in China's wealth is tied up in real estate. If you've got a weaker real estate market, your wealth effect is declined really quite considerably, which means you're probably going to be less inclined to want to spend, and you're going to see that swing from domestic or GDP to foreign trade going back the other way again, where less stuff is consumed domestically and you're looking at the export market. So there are some major challenges facing China, and there is a rub off on that for us here in the West. You know, it's easy to say, oh, they've got problems, that's theirs to sort out, but that's one that's going to cause, you know, carnage depending on the way the ball bounces. So we can explore some of those things and look at some of the investment opportunities around them.
Well, a couple of names that come to my mind would be, say, Fortescue Metals, which dig iron ore out of the ground and ship it to China, or BHP, not as concentrated, but similar type of business.
Yeah. And any of the companies that have got massive trade ties. And look, China's not going to stop importing coal. It's not going to stop importing iron ore. But the major consumer of iron ore is the steel industry, which goes into construction. So if your construction industry is slowing down, then you are going to see that knock-on ramification in iron ore. In fact, you're going to see it across all base metal prices, which we've seen this week. Yeah, I'm not wishing to date this podcast, but this is stuff that is impacting on markets as we speak. So those companies are particularly sensitive to that. But you know, Australia is in an especially vulnerable position because China is our biggest trading partner. And yeah, we've been very fortunate. I guess there's a reason we've been historically called the lucky country, and maybe that luck is about to run out. You know, through the GFC, it was almost a non-event for Australia. Yes, the stock market was volatile, it dropped heavily, and it took an awful long time to recover. But by and large, the economy didn't really implode because the GFC coincided with the mining boom as our relationship with China became ever stronger. A slowdown in that relationship, and notwithstanding, of course, that you know China can import its raw materials it needs from other places. You know, if you think about iron ore, you've got Brazil, albeit you've got to ship it from Brazil to China, it's a bit further away. But also, you know, China's got its own mining interests now in places like Equatorial Guinea, which we've talked about in previous podcasts, which ultimately will come online, and it'll be able to import from its own mines rather than here in Australia. Why would it do that? Well, you know, our relationship with China has become a little fraught recently. You know, things like the submarine deal we've done with the US and the UK has kind of agitated a major trading partner. And so if they decide to turn the tap down, not off, but down a little bit, that's something that has really, really significant ramifications for us here across a broad range of industries. But, you know, it will have the potential for, you know, a fairly catastrophic impact on our economy.
Can you think of any bespoke or, let's say, special situation trades that might come to mind when talking about China? Put you on the spot.
Yeah, look, there's two really easy ways of playing China. If you want the market to go up, or if you want the market, well, maybe not using the term wants, probably correct. If you believe the market's going to move higher, or you're going to move down in terms of the Chinese stock market, well, you can trade the Chinese stock market, not from China, but actually from the NASDAQ in the US by trading a couple of ETFs. These are Yin, YINN, and Yang, YANG, which are triple geared ETFs that are exposed to the Chinese equity market. Now, I'll warn you right now, and for any of our listeners that are tuned into this, these things are pretty spicy. You know, they'll clear your nostrils out pretty quickly. They're running at sort of 90-95% implied volatility.
Three times leverage. So if you held Yang over August, you'd be up 30%, for example. Hang Seng's down 10%.
Exactly right. So, you know, they can move hard and fast. So for someone that's wanting to have not just a passive listen to a conversation about Deng Xiaoping and what happened in 1978, but to see how can I profit from this in today's economy, they're two go-to investments. You can also trade options around both of those too. I think the bullish one, you can do weekly options.
Yang is
monthly. So, you know, there's plenty of opportunity there to be able to trade both underlying ETFs and options around those to maybe use some options to mitigate risk would probably make some sense with given how spicy they are. So, you know, if you're a high risk investor and you want to have some color in your portfolio, there's a place that you could go to that will certainly give you plenty of color and plenty of spice. Those things are, you know, a white phosphorus hot in terms of their ability to move. But I do believe that for mum and dad investors at the other end of the scale, so someone that's not necessarily got a trader's mindset, someone that's not got an aggressive special situations mindset, someone that's just meat and potatoes, got a blue chip equity portfolio, I'd be watching very, very carefully as to what's going on there, because it will have, just like a pebble or a rock being thrown in a pond, there are going to be ripples that move out, and Australia is at that first line of ripple because of our strength of economic ties, and also our weakness of those economic ties too, because we have become rather dependent on our world's second largest economy as our major trading partner.
I think we did a podcast on this maybe 2 or 3 years ago, you know, that's how long it goes back. We've been talking about the reliance on China and how we need to look after our own backyard, and we called it right.
Yeah, it's interesting. And, you know, when you work with centralized economies, which to all intents and purposes is a communist system, the ability for a centralized government to pull the levers in a way that we in the West would sort of raise an eyebrow to and go, really? To deal with these sorts of problems mean that, you know, the Chinese government doesn't have the risk of a social backlash, if you will, for implementing certain types of economic policy. It can just unilaterally decide it's going to do something. And that can work out very, very well if it's the right policy. And I guess, you know, the advantage, yeah, we talked a bit about some of the issues facing China, but I think, you know, on the other side of the coin, if we're talking about yin and yang, we need to look at some of the advantages that China have had. And because they've left their run much, much later compared to a lot of Western countries in terms of the economic expansion they've had the ability to sit back and look at what works and perhaps what doesn't. And I don't think that's something you want to underestimate insofar as, you know, experience is a great teacher. It's even better when it's somebody else's. And they've certainly had the luxury of seeing that, to see how countries, if you take Great Britain as an example, the United Kingdom, how that transitioned out of, you know, the rural to the manufacturing industrial revolution to a service-based economy, and seeing what worked there. Equally, what didn't work. And in just the same way, looking at what happened in Japan, which may well have been, you know, part of the modeling for China's economic and industrial expansion, to see again what worked and what didn't. And in China's case, you know, their interest rates are relatively low, they've been cutting them, whereas during the same problematic time in Japan, they actually had a rising interest rate, which is a material thing. It affects the cost of money. So don't underestimate the benefit of that experience and being able to sit back and, you know, and I think, you know, without being political or banging on a drum of any particular belief system, economic problems, particularly when they're in a major economy in the world, affect everybody, and nobody needs that right now. You know, we've got enough drama with higher interest rates and inflation and uncertainty in property, for example, or migration policy or whatever it may be, that having a very, very strong number two is the sort of thing that keeps the world on its axis and trade still happening. So it's in everybody's interest not to see it implode. I know there will be people on the other side of the coin saying, well, you know, that's probably what they deserve if they hold a particular set of beliefs, but I don't think that's a good outcome for anybody, because, you know, a rising tide lifts all ships, and a falling tide, well, that lets you see who's swimming in the water without swimmers on, and that's not necessarily a sight you want to see.
That's right. Some real challenges in China, but as you say, fingers crossed, they come out the other side and we all prosper on the back of it.
Look, the modeling is there. The amount of foreign reserves in particular and the strength of, you know, the underlying economy is there. It just requires, I think, you know, some very, very strong policy, which, you know, the Chinese government have got a history of taking. Whether you agree with that policy, of course, is another matter, but certainly strong, heavy-handed policy may be just the thing that stewards it through this challenging situation. But if you're a portfolio investor in Australia, I'd be pretty nervous, and I'd be making sure I reduce my exposure and risk to that market particularly, or at least buy some protection on those positions. And if you're at the other end of the coin, then certainly looking to exploit some of the price moves in that market using either yin or yang as geared ETFs, and some of the options around them are some fairly sensible moves. But it's spectacular, the scale of this, just as Japan was. And I remember that was just as I was coming out of university. Japan went from being the darling of, you know, post-World War II economics to a lost decade and some, which it hasn't really recovered from. And that was a heavy burden on the global economy, and this has got the potential to be even more so. So let's hope that they have had the ability to see what's gone on in the world and lay down a game plan that perhaps tiptoes around some of the minds that have tripped people in the past.
Beautiful. Thank you very much, AB.
My pleasure. Anytime, Mitch. There you have it, guys. Make sure you give us a review and a rating, and we'll look forward to hosting you next week.